Accession number 29238, reel 13.
Mr. Wiggum, reel 13. You just found out that the Japanese army had capitulated. What condition were you in physically at this time?
Better condition than we'd been for a little bit, actually. Although my period at the Compton Hospital camp, I again had improved my condition from when I went there, because it was a better camp, comparatively, and the food was again comparatively better. And as I say, I was working for our own folks, you know, and it wasn't a hard physical slog on the railway. And when we got been taken down to Bangkok, we were working with actually fighting troops, about 2,000 fighting troops stationed at the rifle range in Bangkok, and there were 80 of us, party of 8 of us were there, and the captain in charge of them, he was a smart little man. And he said to us, if you work for me, I'll see that you're fed. And he was as good as his word. We weren't flogged for work by any means. You know, it was steady, reasonable work that any man who was reasonably fit could cope with, open air again as well. And he saw to it that we got plenty of food and much better quality than we'd had before. So we had, I forget, 6 to 8 weeks of that. So that by the time we were released, you know, our little group anyway, were in a reasonable physical condition.
What about morale?
Well, morale was all right. That you know, we kept our morale going very well, really. That there's always that something when you get a whole crowd of Britishers together, that there's one geeing the other along, and there's some who got terribly depressed. But for the majority of blokes, they kept their chins up very, very well, really. Even in the worst conditions, you got fed up and you got a bit down at times, but never out. Let's put it that way. You know, that I believe I said earlier on, as a friend of mine said, one of the differences between us and the Eurasian Dutch and Indonesians, they used to talk about if they got home when we were talking about things. Our lads always talked about when we got home. And it's a different attitude, you know. So that we went down, as I said on the previous tape, and down through Bangkok, back to our original billet, the harbour camp on the riverside. And got out of the wagon and lined up in three as normal, and we were met by a Dutch warrant officer. I don't know whether I'd mentioned early on that by that time, the last, I don't know how many weeks it would be, a couple of months, the Japs had separated the officers from the other ranks. Did I mention that? Except from the likes of medical officers and padres. And so there was this Dutch warrant officer was there, and he said that, I'm pleased to be able to tell you all, gentlemen, that you're now free men, the war is over, but until our own relieving troops get here, we're still under the Japanese for rations and discipline. But otherwise, you are free men.
How did the men react to that news?
Well, I was just going to say, If we'd been doing this in Hollywood, we would have probably thrown our hats in the air and jumped about and made a hell of a noise, and one thing or another. And I don't know whether that could have happened elsewhere, I've no idea. But it didn't. I mean, I was standing beside a friend who was actually one of the Cambridges, Gordon Mottram, and we turned to each other and shook hands and said, well, we've made it. And that was it. And we just picked up our what kit we had and climbed up onto the loading bay, you know, the place, and into the big shed, the go down as they call them, to get sort out places for where we were going to settle down. Mind, once everybody was settled down, as you can imagine, it was a bit like a parrot house. Everybody started talking about it, etc., you know. But otherwise, there was no great hijinks or anything like that. We were all just too damn pleased that it was over. And nowhere to celebrate, really. We were way out down on the riverside in these big warehouses.
How did the attitude of the Japanese change towards you for your guards? How did that attitude change?
Well, they were a little bit sullen, I must admit. You know, they weren't as bright and breezy as they had been when Japan was on top. But otherwise, we had no trouble with them. They had trouble with the Thais. There was one of them who was on guard on the actual quay one night, got his throat cut and popped into the river. We heard this horrible howl, you know, and a Thai had sneaked along the wharf and grabbed him and cut his throat and popped him into the river. But otherwise we had no bother. And then, I don't know where he came from, but one of our own officers materialised. And of course he took over. And then an Australian padre, he joined us. Because one of the things I remember, by that time, our fellows were beginning to get down into Bangkok. And the Japanese troops were being herded into the concentration camps, you know. And these were fellows who'd come down out of Burma, being chased out of Burma, of course. And they were in an appalling state. And I was standing beside this Australian padre on the loading, big long loading bay outside the go downs, when a whole heap of these fellas, well, I can't say marched past, they slumped past. And a lot of them looked in worse state than we'd been in. They were really, you know, there was no doubt about the fact that they were beaten. They were absolutely shattered. There was an officer supposed to be leading them, and he must have got terribly blistered feet, because he was had his riding boots off and he was walking in his bare feet, and his orderly was carrying his riding boots slung round his neck behind him. And they were a pathetic sight, really. They were looked terrible. And this Australian padre turned to me and said, you know, Sergeant, he said, I may be a funny Christian, but when I think of what these little blighters have done to our lads over the last 3.5 years, this sight does my heart good. Well, I thought, I couldn't agree with you more, sir. It does mine too, you know. But, oh, they did. They were absolutely shattered. And they were, I don't know, way up past us, rather down the river into some sort of concentration camp. And I hadn't been there many, many days when I was detailed off to go down to the Oriental Hotel, which was going to be the officers' quarters for them coming down country, you know, the officer's reception camp, etc., to go down there as quartermaster. This seemed queer to me. I mean, I was an anti-tank gun commander. I've never been had anything to do with stores all the time, but anyway, I suddenly became a quartermaster of this officer camp. Not that I had much in my stores, mind, when I got there, a precious little few blankets and soup and that sort of thing. And I was there when I got really the what to me personally was the highlight of the do. I was sitting at my desk one day when a Japanese officer, very smartly dressed, he was a captain. A Japanese captain was about the equivalent of our lieutenant colonel. He came walking very smartly up, and my first instinct was to get to my feet and bow to him, you know, who'd done this for 3.5 years. I stopped myself in time and I just sat and watched him coming up, and he stopped in front of my desk. Incidentally, I should say that the Japanese officers occupied the Oriental Hotel before the capitulation, and he stopped smartly in front of my desk, stood to attention, bowed very low, and asked me if I could tell him the Japanese officers were where. Well, I couldn't, I hadn't a clue. So I remember my manners in time, and I slightly reclined my head in return, as you see them do these days, you know, when they meet and they both bow to each other, and said I was sorry I couldn't help, and he thanked me very much and turned smartly round and marched off. And really, you know, I felt a million there, you know, blooming bloke coming bowing to me, a Lance Sergeant, Japanese captain, who at one time, you know, very look from him, you would have shriveled. But,
well, it must have been a good experience after what you've been through.
Oh, it was, believe me. It certainly was, yes. I was only too pleased that I managed to check myself in time to stop rising, you know. But,
what were you doing at this time? What was your role, your job, your daily routine?
Well, just looking after what stores we had, what came in, blankets, and you know, logging them and issuing them when I had to, and any such items as we got, just general sort of store keeping, you know. I had two lads with me who actually had both worked in they were both private Australian privates, and they both worked in the regimental stores. Well, they knew more about storekeeping than I did. The county lads that worked too. And so, funny thing, we got a fair sized party of Japs down on cleaning outside, you know, and they worked pretty hard, given their due. And I got the job of issuing them all with a cake of soap each. I mean, I'd washed in the river with nout or wherever we could get water for 3.5 years, and here I had a dish out of cake of soap to each of these blokes on this working party. You know, it seemed a little bit odd at the time. But it wasn't as odd, really, as some of the lads. We were a queer race, the British. I mean, after all that, saw these lads working, and you know, these poor devils haven't got a smoke. And they went out and they bought cigarettes and came and dished them out among the Japanese prisoners. After all we'd gone through with their hands. You know, we take a bit of understanding, really, don't we? You know? And then, of course, they started getting parties away, out, flying them out from the aerodrome. You know, Dakotas. And I got the chance of a flight out. We had an awkward officer, British officer, who had been made camp superintendent, even a captain, I think. He may have been a major, I don't know. And He wasn't going to let me go. He couldn't get out, you see, until the job was finished. He wasn't at all popular with the other officers. There was a sergeant major in charge of us, and I had a word with him, Sergeant Major Knight. He said, Ludwig, he said, if you're going to get away, let get away. He said, by all means, as far as I'm concerned. And so I went to the officer's lounge and apologised for interrupting, but saw this fellow and said, I have the opportunity for a flight out. Could I have his permission to leave? And then I know I am acting camp quartermaster, but I said, frankly, that I've never been a quartermaster. I had anything to do with stores, all of my service, as I'm a gun commander. And I said, I have two very able Australian lads who've both been storemen, looking after such stores as we have, and there's no sign at the moment of them getting out. And he looked at me, and he wasn't going to let me go, you know. But there were a lot of the officers there, and I say he wasn't popular, and they all sat and they just looked at him. Just looked at him. And in the end, he said, all right, get yourself off. So I got away and met up with my old friend that I mentioned before, Tommy Denton, that he was my section sergeant, you know, he's a lad sergeant in the troop. And we flew out on the same plane together.
How long after the end of the war?
This was about 3 weeks, I think, something like that. I can't remember exactly.
What sort of condition was the city in? Did you get much chance to?
Not too bad. The station, we knew the station had been bombed. In fact, we were working down in the city the day it was bombed. And we saw the planes coming over and saw the muck going up, you know. And there had been a little bit of bombing, but nothing terribly serious. It wasn't really a major military target, I don't think, from Bangkok. Otherwise, I mean, they were flying over and going off to Saigon and places like that, you know. That.
What about the local population? Did you have much to do with them?
No. I didn't get out much because there was nothing to do, really, you know. I mean, we didn't know where to go or anything. And we were warned, as a matter of fact, there was a lot of tension between the resident Chinese and the Thais in the city. In fact, there was some fighting between them. Because the Chinese reckoned that the Thais had they had got over to the Japanese when the poor blighters had no other option, to invade and take it over, and the Thais and the Japanese, the Chinese had taken Thailand citizenship when they came in, so there was a bit of argy-bargy and actual fighting amongst them. And so we were warned, if you go out by the Thais, if you go out at night, gentlemen, walk in the middle of the road. Don't walk on the pavements because it's very dark and the night is very quiet. That was the actual warning we were given, you know. So we didn't go out. We had nowhere to go anyway. So we flew out to Mingledon Aerodrome in Rangoon, and from there we were taken down into, well, it's outside of Rangoon, a good few miles out of Mingledon, and we were run down in ambulances to the city, to the university, as a matter of fact, which had been taken over by the military, and it was a sort of hospital. Although we were walking in okay, we were all hospitalised at first, you know, while they gave us examinations and things, but we weren't fixed in bed or anything like that. We were free to go around all over the place, and I discovered from one of our officers that was a lad I knew well there. They always had Wigan at, he's on the FMSVF, that was the Federated Malay States Volunteer, similar to our territorials. He's on the FMSVF officer, a bloke called Sammy. I don't know what his other name, we all know him as Sammy. Was asking after you, he used to see you on holidays. He's in a mask, I believe it was, somewhere on your... I said, Salmon? Oh, yeah, I said, that's his name. Rennie Salmon. I said, good God, what's Rennie Salmon doing there? He was a merchant naval deck officer. Anyway, I met up with Rennie, and it turned out that his eyesight had stopped any further promotion for him in that direction, so he'd packed up and gone rubber landing. And it turned out that we'd moved up the railway almost together. But of course, it was so changed, both of us, you know, the conditions we were in, that neither of us had recognised the other. And he said, it's such a damn shame, Keith, because he said, you know, I could have helped you because the officers got paid quite a bit more than us. You know, he thought I could have helped you along a bit. But it's all over now, Lenny. He couldn't meet you. So he and I went off down into the city, and he showed me all the places that he knew when he was a young fellow at sea, where it was all going. Ah, you know, when you walk along here at night, you can hear dance bands from every one of these night spots along here, and this sort of thing, you know. But the place was all bombed to bits by then. And we were there. I don't know again how long, probably about 2 or 3 weeks in Rangoon. And then we got a ship out. The old junior. Old ship, but nice ship. I would have gone home on a tugboat, frankly. And Lord Mountbatten came to speak to us, and he said, look, lad, he said, I know you want to get home now. He said, we've got, I guess, 7 ships or something in the river for evacuating you all. But, he said, you know, there's a lot of lads here in the 14th Army. They've been out this way as long as you folks have. And they've had a pretty tough time. And he said, they're getting restive about getting home. In fact, there was a small mutiny among them. He sorted it out. So he said, what I'm doing is I'm giving 2 of those ships to those fellas, and it'll mean you people closing up a bit more on the others. And, as long as we got home, that's all that mattered. But as far as closing up was concerned, when we got on board the Junior, she'd been fitted out as a trooper for the intended invasion of Malaya, and there were 60 of us in a troop space which was fitted out for 240. So we hadn't been closed up very much, you know, plenty of room. And so we were glad to see the back of Bangkok floating away behind us as we went downstream.
And what conditions like on board the ship?
Oh, it was all right. The food was good, and well, we slept on deck, quite frankly. We didn't sleep down in the hammocks, and then it was too hot and stuffy, so we slept on deck. And life was very easy, you know. There was more of a cruise home, really. But we went from there around to Colombo, and in now Sri Lanka, of course. It was then Ceylon. And we moored in the harbour. It was amazing. Well, we went to the biggest harbour of Colombo, and as we went in, there was a naval frigate, or destroyer, or something, guard ship at the bar. And it hooted Viva Victory, and we sailed past. And every ship in the harbour took it up as we moved in, until the whole place was blowing Viva Victory all the way up, you know, what a racket. And we pulled in there, and we were greeted rather strange in a way, really. We were greeted by an Indian Army, I don't know just which regiment or what, Indian Army pipe band playing bagpipes in Highland dress. It was rather strange, but they were a pipe band, you know, and they were good too, I knew they were. And we got ashore at Colombo and did a little bit of shopping, and I was able to order a good sized parcel of Ceylon tea home for my mother, which was very gratefully received when she got it. And that night, Trooper Encelasis came on board and gave us a concert. Maybe not the highest quality, but we enjoyed it. It was very good. And it was nice to see all the ladies. And as a matter of fact, a lot of Wrens and Waff and people looked after us in a big canteen that set up on shore. But, and we were only there 24 hours, I think, and then off we went again. Round to the sewers, but we stopped at Port Tewfik, just before you get to the sewers, just a little place. And we went ashore there, and again there was a canteen set up, and you know, when you went up the Red Sea, everything was just red arid sand and wasteland, it looked, you know, shimmering in the heat. And we pulled into this place in the middle of this, and the canteen set up, and fresh food glistening out of a refrigerator, etc., all free. And we had a good tuck in there. Then they stuck us on a little local rail, narrow gauge railway, and ran us out to a big aerodrome where the hangar had all been set up for, not just for us, I suppose, other troops coming home as well from the Far East, issuing us with battle dress and warmer clothing, which were needed actually when we got out of the sewers into the med.
Had you had any fresh clothing by this time?
Oh yes, we'd for years I wore them in the summer, a Burma green jacket and that, you know, particularly if out and they were walking in the country, the jackets were blooming useful in their big patch pockets and things. And yes, we'd been issued with clothing. And we set off from there and went through the Suez Canal. And we, let me see now. Oh yes, while we were there, Tommy Denton's cousin arrived. She was in the ATS, and she knew we were coming, and an RAF lad was detailed off to escort her down. And she came and met us, because we had also met up with an old school friend of mine who I didn't even know until we were taken prisoner that he was in our division, and he was in one of the field regiments. And I still see him at the SME Club at Shields, Billy Wallace. And then we set off through the Suez Canal, went through at night, and it was an interesting run through. And we got into the Mediterranean, and the blue Mediterranean was grey as slate. It wasn't blue all the time, it was choppy and it was grey, but it wasn't rough, you know. And there we were issued with a bottle of beer a man every night. And our medical officers came on the tannoy and asked us, even if we were normally teetotalers, would we take it and treat it as medicine, because we were all so short of vitamin B, etc., and beer was full of vitamins. Well, I wasn't teetotal, but I'd never tasted neat beer in my life until then. I'd used to drink shandies with the lads, you know, just have a shandy, you have them. So the first time I had beer on its own. But we got this one bottle a night, and we drank it. And we ploughed our way through the med. And on the ship there was a laddie that I got very friendly with, a youngster, he was only 14. tall, thin, freckled-faced, ginger-haired laddie. And called David Sparrow. He'd been a civilian internee. And we used to spend a lot of time together. On board, you know, he's a nice kid. And just chatting away there. I say kid, he'd be, I think, you know, he'd be about 72 now. But